2011 Salt Lake Sunstone Symposium, Pursuing the Historical Roots of Mormon Black Priesthood Denial, Personal Reflections and a Progress Report. Panelists Newell G. Bringhurst, Dennis Lithgow, and Armand L. Mouth.
In a way, it's a little bit like old family reunion. I notice a number of relatives out in the audience. My father and my brother. I'm from out of town, so it's nice to see relatives. I've got a distant cousin, Dale Beckstead, back there, and then another cousin in the back of the room, Corey McGregor. And so it's great. You know, half the audience is my family. You know, that's at least that helps to boost up the attendance. But I just want to, we're each going to give a little bit different kind of presentations. I just want to say a little bit about each of the participants, more about the other two than myself. But these two gentlemen, Dennis Lithgow immediately to my left and Armand Moss on the end, they got involved with the Mormon Black issue quite a bit before I did. Armand started to do work when he was a student at the University of California, Berkeley, and he did a doctoral dissertation, which was finally completed in 1970, Mormonism and Minorities in the Department of Sociology. And then he went on to write two path-breaking articles, both of which were published in Dialogue, also in the mid to late 60s. One was published in the Pacific Sociological Review, Mormonism and Secular Attitudes Toward Negroes. That appeared in the fall of 1966. And then his piece in Dialogue was published in the winter of 1967, and it dealt with Mormonism and the Negro: Faith, Folklore, and Civil Rights. And he did a very fine piece after the lifting of the ban, after the revelation of 78, in Dialogue, The Fading of the Pharaoh's Curse, The Decline and Fall of the Priesthood Ban Against Blacks and the Mormon Church. And then in 1999, while not directly dealing with the issue of blacks in the church, he did what's kind of a preview of what's going to be his forthcoming book. I don't have the title in front of me. I'm sure he'll be glad to tell it to you. It's in the hands of University of Illinois Press, but it's an overall study of race and ethnicity within the church that he's been working on for years and years, which we've long anticipated. But he gave a portion of the ideas in his presidential address. He's a past president of the Mormon History Association, In Search of Ephraim, published in the spring 1999 Journal of Mormon History. Now, Dennis Lithgow, I'm sure those of you who are live here in the Salt Lake area are familiar with Dennis because of his column, his book review, as a writer for the Deseret News, and Dennis has had a long distinguished academic career and a long time interest in the Mormon Black issue. Like Armand, he did a thesis, in fact he brought a copy of it with him, Negro Slavery in Utah, which was completed, I believe, 1966. Isn't that correct? And he also wrote a couple of articles, one in the Utah Historical Quarterly dealing with black slavery in Utah, and then on the larger issue of the race issue in the Western Humanities Review. And this is the background of the my two fellow participants. As for myself, I came on the Mormon Black issue a little bit later. I took it on as a dissertation topic at the University of California, Davis, and I had the issue and the task in front of me for 10 long years. My dissertation was completed in 1975, before the 78 revelation, and then then I revised it, modified it, and resulted in my particular book, Saints, Slaves, and Blacks, The Changing Place of Blacks Within Mormonism, which was published in 1981. And so we've all had experience in confronting and grappling with the issue of blacks, the history of blacks in the church. And we're going to be kind of doing a little bit of, kind of going off in a little bit different directions. Dennis is going to provide kind of a retrospect explaining how he got involved and interested in the issue. He's going to go first, and then I will go next. I'm going to be talking about the Missouri Thesis Revisited, kind of the it was the basic component, which was which many people feel was a key to understanding the implementation of black priesthood denial, and which was the centerpiece of a number of studies. I'm going to be dealing with that, and then Armin Moss is going to be dealing with developments that have occurred, progress and developments that have occurred concerning Mormon black relations since the 1978 revelation. So that's the order in which we will proceed.
Can you hear me now? Okay, it works. Well, I think that being together in this kind of a group is an honor, because those of you who are here probably have long worried about this issue. This was the sort of thing that bothered me very early in life as a Mormon growing up in Salt Lake City, wondering why it was that blacks could not hold a priesthood. I remember thinking and struggling with this issue very early. I had three friends in high school who were black, and that was it. That's not exactly a lot like that. That's probably a typical Utah experience, if you had any at all. I always felt as though something was deeply wrong there. So obviously I came to this with a little bit of a personal axe to grind. I always wondered why this occurred, because I never could figure it out from church meetings or from readings or from sermons or any other particular source. So when I studied history at the University of Utah, I went on for a master's degree and then a doctorate. And when I got to the master's level, I was trying to figure out some interesting topic for a master's thesis. And most of my professors had told me that the most important thing that you could do was find a topic that was interesting, because you spend an awful lot of time on it. And so the worst thing that you could do is pick something that you become bored out of your mind with halfway through, and probably end up doing a poor job. So I thought about a lot of things, and I determined that Negro slavery in Utah would be a good topic. Now, that's, of course, politically incorrect now. I'm ashamed of the name now. I would have called it black slavery in Utah, or African-American slavery in Utah, or whatever was current at the time. But it certainly is out of touch now. But it represents what was widely used in the 1960s. So this was the period, of course, of great racial introspection in the United States. And as a history student, I think that's one of the reasons that I also gravitated toward it. My chairman for the master's degree was Philip Sturgis, a colonial historian, non-Mormon, transplant to Utah. And he wanted very much that I choose my own topic. And so when I announced to him what my topic was, he sputtered. He could not believe it. And he said, I think that's a mistake. And I said, well, why? And he said, well, because you will never find anything on it. And why is that? Because the materials for it will all be found in the church archives, and they won't let you in. He said, let me think about this and talk to some of my colleagues and see if I can come up with a counter topic for you. So I met with him about a week later, and his new topic was the beer industry of Utah. He said, this has never been done. It would be a major contribution, and considering the fact that people come to Utah all the time and they drive into the state and it says, welcome to Utah, the home of Fisher beer. It's about time we explore that topic. Well, I said, well, I'm not a drinker, and I'm not interested in beer, and I'd rather pursue something that would guarantee my interest. So reluctantly, he let me proceed, but I could tell he thought I was going to fail miserably. I also had a long talk with T. Edgar Lyon, who maybe some of you remember, a longtime institute teacher and very important Mormon historian in his own right, particularly in terms of teaching it. T. Edgar gave me a little bit of advice about approaching the archives. And so he suggested that I should not go in with too much of an academic flavor, that I should try to be as down-to-earth as possible and, you know, sort of strike up a friendship. And so I remember going in to talk to A. Will Lund, who's been mentioned a couple of times around here today. Most people have various memories of him. He was the assistant church historian at the time, assistant to Joseph Fielding Smith, and a very old man, and known for his rigid personality and his lack of a sense of humor. At least that's what everyone said about him. So I was ushered into his office and sat down, and he looked at me and asked what I wanted to do. And I told him I wanted to write a master's thesis on Negro slavery in Utah. And then there was a huge silence. No change of expression. He looked down. He seemed to think long and hard. And then he said to me, there was no Negro slavery in Utah. Oh, okay. So I realized I had a very big problem here. Fortunately, I had done a lot of reading up to this point in general sources, and so I argued with him gently. I said I believed that there in fact was slavery in Utah, and that I had consulted a number of sources and indicated that was the case, that it was not nearly as extensive as it was elsewhere in the United States, but that it was certainly here, and that there was evidence to support that. So then there was a big silence again. And then he pulled out of his drawer a form, a long white form, filled out something on the top, asked me to sign it, told me the rules of the archives, that I had to let everyone see, all workers in the archives see what I had, what my notes were when I left, etc., etc. The old days of working in the church archives. And I left a happy man. I had gotten past A. Will Lund. So T. Edgar got a great kick out of that story to think that he would, he says, well, he was testing you. If you had not been able to stand up for this issue, then he wouldn't have let you in. Well, I was still told that I would have a great deal of trouble getting away with any of the stuff that I needed, because they do really regularly consult what you take. They give you a little bit at a time in those days. But it worked out. It got so that when I was wandering around the archives, people got used to me. They thought, I mean, I was just a young student. I had a little bit of hair in those days, and so I looked, I think, harmless. And I was able to get access, I think, to everything that I could reasonably expect. Now, this is a very formative stage, you have to remember. I mean, I'm working on this in 1965, when the only thing that I could find that was written on it was Jack Beller's 1929 article in Utah Historical Quarterly called Negro Slaves in Utah. And so I proceeded. I devoured everything I could. I tried to put it all together. And that's the product, this thing that gives a little background on slavery in the United States. Studies a little bit about the theology of Mormons, tries to relate the social issue of slavery to Utah as it applied in the United States, includes a number of quotations from church leaders, particularly Joseph Smith and Brigham Young, to illustrate their attitude toward blacks. And my general conclusion was that this was a social issue as far as the Mormons were concerned that did not mean very much at the time, because they were concentrating on building a religion. And they really had not settled on what they thought particularly applied to the black versus the white. And they were interested in doing anything they could to please those among whom they lived. Now, in terms of tracing any kind of revelation, any kind of pronouncement by church leadership that blacks should not hold the priesthood, there was none. I found oblique references in various places, most notably the L. John Nuttall diary, in which he recounted a conversation held in 1879 with Zebedee Coltrane, in which they remembered conversations with Joseph Smith and expressed the idea that although Elijah Abel, the first known black to hold the priesthood, had held it, that Joseph Smith had proclaimed he shouldn't have. Now, that was a secondhand account taken many years later. And so my conclusions in all of this was that this was not a theological question. This was a social practice that had evolved, and that Mormons really today had no idea why blacks did not hold the priesthood, even though it was talked about as almost a sacred issue in church circles. I inevitably had to write a chapter about the priesthood question, and I found in doing that many, to me, troubling statements by church leaders, even up including to the present day. My most vivid memory of Mark E. Peterson's famous speech on race issues as they affect the church, in which he upheld the principle of segregation. Although I had completed this, I knew there was a lot more to do. And so I was grateful that I had an opportunity to sort of be on the ground floor. You know, that's where I think I was in this. I did something against the wishes of my scholarly committee. They let me go by once they saw. They thought it was substantial enough to award me a master's degree. But then it took Newell Bringhurst and Armand Moss and Lester Bush to flesh this thing out and make it into the fully complete study that it now is, so that we can read so many more documents than I had access to at the time, and give a better balanced view of what was involved here. I would add a little postscript that I continue to be bothered by this issue after I had written this thesis. I wrote a doctoral dissertation on a different issue, and I went away to Boston to teach. And while there, I was called as a bishop and was bothered because we had several black members of the ward there. And one black family in particular with three young boys. And one of the greatest, most vivid memories of my life is hearing a rumor by a member of the ward that the president of the church had announced a revelation that blacks would now hold the priesthood. I called Salt Lake City to verify, and the next morning, Sunday morning, I ordained one of those young men to the priesthood. My first counselor ordained another. My second counselor ordained another. The mother of these young men sat there sobbing, and we had a good cry together. And I will always remember that in a personal sense, to finally be able to get this off my back. Not to say that I would never have to explain the issue again, but whenever talking about whether Mormonism was relevant or not, that you wouldn't have to say, well, why is it that a church would deny priesthood to people on the basis of color? So,
thanks, Dennis. I just thought I'm not going to go into much of a personal recapitulation of how I got involved. I just thought I'd mention, as sort of a preface, that I came at it kind of the opposite way that Dennis did. Actually, I had wanted to do another topic. I was at the University of California, Davis, and I wanted to do it on mining entrepreneurs in the West, and because I'd done a master's thesis on that same topic. But unfortunately, somebody ahead of me got to that topic, who was ahead of me in the doctoral program, and I was thrashing around for a topic, and it was actually my cousin-in-law, the husband of my cousin, and he was a fellow student with me at the University of California, Davis, and he'd come back from a mission in Brazil, and he'd confronted it as a problem, as an issue there, and he said, well, why don't you do it on the Mormon black issue? And I said, well, no, I don't think I should, for two reasons. Number one, you're much better qualified than I am because you're a returned missionary and you're close to the church, whereas I'm not that involved with the church, and I don't know if I could really do an objective job with this highly controversial issue. And it was surprising what he said to me. He says, Newell, because of my experiences of having seeing this problem in Brazil, I feel like I'm too emotionally involved with the issue, but I feel that you're a fair-minded individual, and I think that you would really, in your heart of hearts, try to approach it in an objective manner. And I hope that, you know, those of you who have read my book, Saints, Slaves, and Blacks, and some of the other things I've tried to do that, and maybe it won't always appear that way, but I have striven for objectivity. But I just thought I'd mention that as just a little bit of a personal aside. I want to move it in sort of a different direction in building upon what Dennis said, you know, about the origins. And that's what my paper really focuses on, is the Missouri Thesis Revisited, Early Mormonism, Slavery, and the Status of Black People. In the light of the approaching 25th anniversary of the 1978 Mormon revelation lifting the ban on black priesthood denial, it seems appropriate to revisit the Missouri Thesis, at one time seen as the key to understanding the origins of this now defunct practice. In addition to examining the Missouri Thesis, this presentation evaluates recent scholarship attempting to provide new insights on early LDS attitudes towards slavery and race. First to articulate the Missouri Thesis was none other than Fawn McKay Brody through her highly controversial No Man Knows My History, published in 1945. According to Brody, the origins of Mormon black priesthood denial were rooted in Mormon-non-Mormon conflicts in the slave state of Missouri during the 1830s. Those Latter-day Saints who had migrated to Missouri from non-slave regions of Ohio, New York, and New England sought to prevent further misunderstanding on the issues of race and slavery by adopting a pro-slavery, anti-black position, including priesthood denial. Brody also saw a direct relationship between the Book of Abraham and black priesthood denial, asserting that the Book of Abraham maintained that blacks, as the alleged descendants of Ham, were doomed to be both a servant of servants and denied the right of priesthood. Thus, the Book of Abraham, in Brody's words, expressed Smith's theorizing on the subject of race while crystallizing his vacillating position on the Negro problem, as she termed it. Brody characterized the Book of Abraham as, quote, the most unfortunate thing Joseph ever wrote, and black priesthood denial as the ugliest thesis in existing Mormon theology. Following Brody's lead, other scholars writing during the 1950s and 1960s utilized elements of the Missouri Thesis. These included L.H. Kirkpatrick, Jan Shipps, and Dennis L. Lithgow, and Naomi Woodbury. But it was Stephen L. Taggart who produced the most thoroughly researched and widely circulated work linking black priesthood denial to church difficulties in Missouri. Taggart's Mormonism's Negro Policy, and I have a copy of it. It's a little book. It sort of reminds me of, you know, it's almost an inconsequential looking book. I'm always reminded of what Abraham Lincoln said about Harriet Beecher Stowe, or so you're the little lady that wrote this book that started this great big war in a way. You know, it was a very little book, which caused a lot of waves. It's not a huge volume, smaller than your dissertation or your thesis. But anyway, Taggart's book attracted a lot of attention, and in it he maintained that the first hint of the emergence of excluding blacks from the priesthood came after the Latter-day expulsion from Jackson County. Taggart implicated Joseph Smith through the 1879 recollections of Zebedee Coltrane and Abraham Smoot, both of whom knew the Mormon prophet. Coltrane recalled that in 1834, he had argued with fellow Latter-day Saint J.P. Green the issue of whether the Negro, I'm quoting here, had a right to the priesthood. I took up the side he had no right, whereas Brother Green argued that he did. I think it's ironic because Green ended up being a brother-in-law of Brigham Young. I think that's kind of interesting little thing, but that's in the future. But to settle this dispute, Coltrane and Green immediately consulted Joseph Smith. The Mormon leader, as recalled by Coltrane, kind of dropped his head and rested for a minute. And this is a quote, and then a quote within a quote. And then he said, this is Coltrane recalling, "Brother Zebedee, it is right, for the Spirit of the Lord saith, the Negro has no right and nor cannot hold the priesthood." This is quote within a quote. He made no reference to Scripture at all, but such was his decision, unquote. Smoot, according to Taggart, had confronted the issue of black ordination while doing missionary work in the southern states in 1835 and 36. At the time, some blacks made application for baptism, and the question arose whether Negroes were entitled to hold the priesthood. A decision was held off until Joseph Smith was consulted. The Mormon leader's decision, as Smoot understood it, was that they, black slaves, were not entitled to the priesthood nor yet to be baptized without the consent of their masters. Smoot also claimed that Joseph Smith reaffirmed this position at Far West, Missouri in 1838, stating that Smith instructed Smoot that, quote, this is Smoot quoting, "I could baptize black slaves by consent of their masters, but not to confer the priesthood upon them." Taggart also noted that during the 1830s, the Mormons abandoned their initial abolitionist tendencies, assuming a pro-slavery posture with supporting theological arguments. Joseph Smith led the way, quoting certain passages from the Bible, affirming that the holding of the sons of Ham or Canaan in servitude. Smith then stated, quote, "I can say that the curse is not yet taken off the sons of Canaan, neither will be until it is affirmed by as great a power as caused it to come," unquote. Mormon pro-slavery tendencies were further strengthened after Joseph Smith fled Kirtland and moved to Far West in March 1838, making Missouri, in the words of Taggart, the center of Mormonism. Initially, the expedient of denying blacks the priesthood, and this is what Taggart maintains, was without theological underpinning. However, by the mid-1830s, Smith contemplated the development of a theological justification for the practice. Providing this was a crucial section of the Book of Abraham, which Smith began translating in July 1835. The crucial passages in question focused on Pharaoh and the Egyptians, identified as ancestors of Ham. Pharaoh was described as, quote, "a descendant from the loins of Ham, a partaker of the blood of the Canaanites by birth." The Book of Abraham suggests that Noah's son Ham perpetuated the seed of Cain through his wife Egyptus, who is of Canaanite descent, and that consequently Ham's descendants were forbidden to hold the priesthood. This Book of Abraham passage provided the final crucial element necessary for establishing black priesthood denial, so asserts Taggart. Mormonism's Negro policy, as I suggested, attracted widespread notice from both within and outside of Mormonism, and was generally praised. In fact, I got an old clipping from the New York Times right after the book came out. It was noted in as far away as New York in the New York Times, and really attracted a lot of notice. But not convinced by Taggart's arguments was fellow scholar Lester E. Bush, hard at work on his own study of the Mormon black issue. Bush questioned both the facts and the basic validity of Taggart's Missouri thesis in two seminal essays published in Dialogue, a Journal of Mormon Thought. The first, a commentary on Stephen G. Taggart's Mormonism's Negro Policy, appeared in early 1970, shortly after Taggart's book came out. Specifically, Bush questioned Taggart's effort to place the origins of Mormon black priesthood denial in the 1830s. Bush was unconvinced by the 1879 testimonies of Zebedee Coltran and Abraham O. Smoot, which he dubbed highly suspect. The testimony of Coltran, he proclaimed, was an artifact recorded 45 years after the fact, making it unwise to accept its details without question. More serious was the fact that Coltran himself ordained an early African American Mormon named Elijah Abel to the priesthood office of 70 in December 1836. Smoot's testimony was also tainted, but by Smoot's inherent prejudices as a native-born pro-slavery Southerner, descended from a long line of Southern slaveholders. Smoot himself, in fact, owned two black slaves, which he acquired after he had migrated to Utah. Bush also questioned Taggart's assertion that Joseph Smith intended the Book of Abraham as a theological justification for black priesthood denial. Bush pointed to Taggart's own admission that the Book of Abraham was vague and cannot be said to justify denying blacks the priesthood to blacks. Bush also noted a lack of evidence that Joseph Smith ever used the Book of Abraham as a proof text to justify black priesthood denial. According to Bush, the earliest known documentation for the policy of black priesthood denial came from Brigham Young in February 1849, some 5 years after Joseph Smith's death. Bush continued with his own research on the Mormon black issue. In 1973, he presented his findings in a second dialogue essay, Mormonism's Negro Doctrine, A Historical Overview. In continuing to refute the Missouri thesis, Bush suggested that certain pro-slavery statements made by Joseph Smith and other church leaders during the mid-1830s were not simply a response to events in Missouri, but were as much, if not more, a reaction against increased abolitionist activities in various northern communities, especially Kirtland, Ohio, where a local chapter of the American Anti-Slavery Society was established in 1836. And I should add parenthetically that the abolitionists at that time, we look at them as heroes today, but at that time, most Americans considered as the abolitionists as radical rabble-rousers. They were detested and really condemned by almost all Northerners. There are very few people. They looked at them as a radical fringe group. So, you know, the Mormons, according to Bush, were just sort of acting in the norm of what was going on in the larger American society. Now, turning to the specific issue of blacks and the priesthood, Bush affirmed that in spite of the many discussions of blacks and slavery that had been published by 1836, no reference had been made to priesthood. Bush continued to affirm his basic argument that Brigham Young and not Joseph Smith inaugurated black priesthood denial, thereby refuting the core tenet of the Missouri thesis. Despite Bush's compelling, well-documented arguments, the Missouri thesis continued to be accepted by certain respected scholars and writers of Mormon studies, including the likes of Thomas F. O'Day, Mark Leone, Dean May, and Klaus J. Hansen. Hansen, in his Mormonism and the American Experience, affirmed certain aspects of the Missouri thesis in critiquing and criticizing Lester Bush and his work. Hansen felt that Bush had overstated his case. Hansen maintained that the Saints, in the wake of their 1833 expulsion from Jackson County, Missouri, seemed to have learned their lesson, and from then on discouraged missionary activity among blacks, while at the same time hardening their racial position, at least in part as a result of such persecutions in Missouri. Hansen also disagreed with Bush's discussion of, or rather dismissal, of the Book of Abraham and its significance in the Mormon black issue. Quoting Hansen, quote, "Assuming that Joseph Smith believed there was a link between Ham and the modern Negro, the Book of Abraham is indeed the linchpin in the Negro doctrine." Then Hansen carefully added, quote, "The fact that neither Joseph nor Brigham Young apparently felt it necessary to use the Book of Abraham as proof text does not negate my point." In this regard, Hansen was reminded, and again I'm quoting Hansen, of Jacob Burckhardt's comment that everywhere in the past we encounter things which remain unexplained only because they were so completely self-understood in their time, unquote. Hansen then concluded, if Joseph Smith was not the author of the Negro Doctrine, there are plausible historical reasons why he should have been, unquote. Also questioning Bush, but at the same time attempting to move beyond the Missouri thesis, was Latter-day Saint scholar Ronald K. Esplin in a significant 1979 essay, Brigham Young and Priesthood Denial to the Blacks, an Alternative View. Esplin, like Hansen, asserted that Joseph Smith, rather than Brigham Young, initiated the doctrine of black priesthood denial. But in contrast to Hansen, Esplin didn't look back or go back to the 1830s or Mormon difficulties in Missouri. Instead, he based his arguments on events in Nauvoo during the 1840s. Black priesthood denial, argued Esplin, emerged in 1842-43 in relationship to and concurrent with Joseph Smith's introduction of the more advanced temporal rituals developed at that time. Esplin, however, failed to produce contemporary documentation directly linking Joseph Smith to or having him decree black priesthood denial. That was the big weakness of his whole argument. But Esplin did produce a crucial, heretofore unknown, April 1847 statement by Apostle Parley P. Pratt, stating the blacks, because of their lineage, as the blood of Ham, were cursed as regards to the priesthood. This document had the effect of pushing the affirmation of black priesthood denial back into the pre-Utah period, and 2 years earlier than the April 1849 date that had been established by Bush. According to Esplin, Pratt's statement, offhandedly referring to black priesthood denial, was specifically prompted by the unauthorized activities at Winter Quarters by a William McCary, a black Indian whom Pratt characterized as a black man with the blood of Ham in him, which lineage is cursed as regards to the priesthood. Esplin suggested that Pratt's statement reflected prior knowledge of black priesthood denial as a well-established practice well before 1847. As for Brigham Young, Esplin asserted that the Utah Mormon leader throughout his lifetime, but especially during the early period of his leadership, saw himself charged by Joseph Smith to carry out the Mormon prophet's specific program, a program which by implication included black priesthood denial. In particular, the early brethren were concerned about priesthood lineage and about who would have access to temple ordinances. According to Esplin, and this is somewhat of a lengthy quote, even if Joseph did not raise the question himself, it is not difficult to envision somebody asking about the blacks and Joseph providing the answer. It is my feeling that the doctrine was introduced in Nauvoo and consistently applied in practice by at least 1843, although it would require additional documentation to raise the possibility from the realm of the probable to the certain. So he's adding that little caveat on the end. The Esplin's thesis prompted a response from Lester E. Bush in a 1984 essay, Whence the Negro Doctrine, a review of 10 years of answers. And that's contained in this volume, which, in fact, Armin, he's the co-editor of this, and it's an excellent overview of the scholarship, neither white nor black. I think it's even available I think it's still in print. It is, maybe that'll prod him to put it back in print. But it's really an excellent, it's really a good collection of essays that were published by Armin, by Lester Bush, and there's one in there by me, myself. But anyway, Lester Bush wrote an essay, it was the last essay in this volume, in which he updates and he's responding to Esplin's essay, which was published in 79. Now, Bush found merit in Esplin's effort to link black policies with the development of certain new temporal rituals in Nauvoo. But at the same time, he found Esplin's essay lacking in contemporary documentation. Thus, Bush rejected Esplin's central argument, asserting instead that it was difficult to believe that a concrete policy of priesthood denial dated much before the spring of 1847, given the apparent chronology of the actual practice. Now, other writers coming after this moved beyond the Missouri thesis by focusing on Mormon ethnicity. And I'm sure Armin will have more to say about that, but because that's been an area where he's done a lot of work. But prior to Armin, Klaus J. Hansen, in his 1981 Mormonism and the American Experience, was the first scholar. A growing sense of Mormon lineage self-consciousness to the implementation of black priesthood denial. I did the same thing in my Saints, Slaves, and Blacks, which came out slightly after Klaus Hansen. I mean, we did this research independently. I was surprised at how closely our findings converged on that point of Mormon ethnicity. Hansen asserted that over time, early Latter-day Saints identified themselves as literal descendants of the House of Israel. Joseph Smith believed himself a literal descendant of Ephraim, divinely chosen to gather all the descendants of Ephraim, predominantly found among white Europeans. God had singled out the seed of Abraham for special blessings, according to Mormon belief. Other ethnic groups, however, were less favored in somewhat descending hierarchical order. Black Americans of African descent, considered the literal descendants of Cain, Ham, and Canaan, were the very least favored, insofar as blessings and status within Mormonism. Another scholar who further elaborated on the role of Mormon ethnic identity on evolving Latter-day Saint practices was Rex Eugene Cooper. I always wondered if he was sort of a relative, because I come from a line of Coopers. I don't know. On my mother's side. In an important, often overlooked 1990 book, Promises Made to the Fathers, Mormon Covenant Organization, Cooper dated certain crucial developments from the 1830s. According to Cooper, by the time of the 1838-9 Mormon expulsion from Missouri, a code of conduct evident in the behavioral qualifications associated with the baptismal covenant and substance or blood, as manifested in the concept of Abrahamic descent, had clearly emerged as conceptual basis for solidarity within the Mormon group. That's the essence of Cooper's assertions. A third scholar, Robert Ben Madison, also emphasized the importance of Mormon ethnicity as a link to restrictive policies affecting blacks. Madison's 1992 essay, Heirs According to the Promise, Observations on Ethnicity, Race, and Identity in Two Factions of 19th Century Mormonism, was unique and somewhat path-breaking in that he considered evolving Mormon ethnicity from a comparative perspective, looking at two different Mormon groups. Madison argued that the forces which led to Mormon ethnicity did not impact the same on all segments of the Mormon community. Madison contrasted relevant developments within the Utah Mormon Church with those occurring within the reorganized church. On one side, Utah Mormons saw themselves as heirs to the Old Testament, whereby they emphasized and reinforced their earlier established identity as the literal restored Israel of white European or Anglo-Saxon Abrahamic blood. By contrast, those Latter-day Saints who did not go west, forming the basis of the reorganized church, did not view themselves ethnically, but simply as heirs to the New Testament. Thus, the RLDS, now the Community of Christ, viewed ethnic considerations as sublimated to those of the promise by which Gentiles, both white and black, were figuratively adopted and entitled to Abraham's blessings by virtue of their accepting the lordship of the God of Israel. In this spirit, Joseph Smith III, as RLDS president, prophet, seer, and revelator, declared in early 1865 that, quote, the prejudices of race, color, and caste would soon be done away with among the saints.
Then that same year, through revelation, Smith declared that, quote, "It is expedient in me that you ordain priests unto me of every race who receive the teachings of my law and become heirs of the promise," thus giving us allowing for black ordination within that denomination. The inclusive RLDS approach stood in sharp contrast to the anti-black beliefs and related practices within the Utah Mormon Church. In conclusion, what do all of these varied findings tell us? One thing is clear. Both Vaughn Brody and Stephen L. Taggart overstated their cases in promoting the Missouri thesis. What about the varied, sometimes conflicting findings of Lester E. Bush, Ronald Esplin, Klaus Hansen, Rex E. Cooper, and Robert Ben Madison? What do they tell us about the Missouri experience in relationship to evolving Mormon attitudes on race and the place of blacks? In a sense, as I suggest, we're left with more questions than answers. But what is clear is that Mormon racial practices developed in a complex, seemingly contradictory, often tangled fashion. As for the Mormon Missouri experience itself, while not as crucial as once thought, events in Missouri during the 1830s cannot be discounted completely out of hand, but they must be considered within the broader context of incidents elsewhere affecting the church both before and after the 1830s. Thank you.
Now the rest of the story. What I'm going to present will be excerpts from Chapter 9 of my forthcoming book entitled All Abraham's Children, subtitle Changing Mormon Conceptions of Race and Lineage. I'll do some reading and some just talking. In the quarter century since the new revelation was announced, much has changed, but some problems remain. The most conspicuous change has certainly been the rapid growth of the church, especially among black populations of Africa, Brazil, and the West Indies, and elsewhere. The growth in these places has provided ample vindication for the earlier expectations of church leaders that these populations were especially receptive to the LDS gospel. I mean, church leaders in the 60s like Hugh B. Brown. Similar vindication can also be claimed for my own earlier contention that such pressure as church leaders had felt to drop the priesthood restriction in 1978 came mainly from the enormous missionary potential beckoning from locations like West Africa and Brazil. As I indicated earlier, the details on church growth among black peoples outside the U.S. are beyond the scope of this chapter, but are recounted elsewhere. Conditions affecting durable church growth in these countries with predominantly black populations are, of course, altogether different from the factors affecting growth among blacks in the United States, with which I'm concerned here. It is difficult to ascertain just how successful Mormon missionary work has been among American blacks since 1978. Ordinary church records do not keep track of race or ethnicity, so we are dependent on unsystematic samples and anecdotal evidence. Certainly, the church publications have given more exposure than ever before to stories of black conversion, spiritual and social growth of new black members, and their inspiring encounters with divine influences. A sheer count of such stories would be misleading, however, since a large disproportion of them deal with cases outside the United States. Newell Bringhurst made a study of how the church news presented the image of blacks as prime instruments of church growth and expansion. during the first decade after 1978. He concluded that in strictly geographic terms, the church had made great strides into large sections and populations of the world traditionally neglected by LDS missionaries. In numerical terms, however, Bringhurst found Church News claims of rapid black growth to be a little exaggerated in some of the countries, and in the United States, growth was actually quite slow. Despite the strained history of Mormon relationships with blacks and a studied avoidance of black proselyting by the church before 1978, American blacks have occasionally joined the church from the very beginning, but especially since World War II. One informed Utah journalist, Heidi Swinton, estimated that the church had 2,000 black members even before the priesthood policy was changed. Most of these seem to have been attracted to the church through friendships with individual white Mormons encountered in the workplace or during military service. As noted above, such estimates can be only informed guesses. But whatever their actual number, these converts, American black joining the church now, these converts have been remarkable for their ability to look beyond all the trappings of racism to the Mormon spiritual core. A few of them have left behind accounts of their conversions, which reveal a variety of more or less successful efforts to deal with the cognitive dissonance and external black criticism involved in joining the Mormons. I shall have more to say about this predicament a little later. Conversions of American blacks to the LDS Church seem to have waxed and waned with the local conditions and initiatives. And by no means have missionary efforts been limited to blacks in Utah. A major drive during the early 1980s by the Mormon Mission in North Carolina brought in some 900 black converts. But a few years later, only 100 remained active in the church. President O. Ken Earle, during 1983-85, headed the LDS Mission in Northern California, based in Oakland. He gave special proselyting attention to the large black population in the Oakland area, and his missionaries succeeded in baptizing 93 new black members, constituting about 5% of all the converts in the mission during that period. Most of these lived in two Oakland wards or congregations in particular, and they provided the nucleus for the organization of the Northern California chapter of the Utah-based Genesis Group, which I've talked about earlier and will come back to again. This level of growth and enthusiasm in Oakland, however, did not long survive President Earle's departure. Yet during the 1990s, one of Earle's black families had become prominent members of a suburban ward in the East Bay area. The Watts area of southwest Los Angeles produced enough black converts for a branch of some 100 people a little more than a year later, almost all of whom were black. Missionary successes with blacks have attracted attention in other important urban centers of the nation as well, including the South Bronx and East St. Louis. Additional, if temporary, surges in missionary success with American blacks elsewhere have often been reported anecdotally. One important source of such reports is the collection of African American oral histories compiled by the Oral History Program of the Charles Redd Center at BYU, where Jesse Embry is the director. This program is devoted to collecting oral histories from various special ethnic and other groups in the Mormon orbit. For the Afro-American Oral History Project, 225 black Mormons, mostly recent converts, were interviewed during the period 1985 to 89, and most of these interviews were done by Alan Cherry, an early black convert and still prominent black leader in Utah. Although these interviews were conducted in various parts of the United States, they constituted essentially an opportunity sample of black Mormons, not at all a representative one. Particularly overlooked in the sample were members who had dropped out of church activity. Nevertheless, the oral history interviews were numerous enough to reveal a great range of social characteristics and life circumstances among the converts, as well as a variety of experiences with conversion, disillusionment, and acceptance in the Mormon community. The quality of these experiences has been captured in an important book based on the interviews, Jesse Embry's book, and a number of articles have been published from the quantitative data yielded by the same interviews. Taken altogether, this published work is qualitatively very rich. It indicates that those American blacks who joined the Mormon Church and remained active in the decade after the change in priesthood policy were disproportionately young, well-educated, upwardly mobile socially, and largely of Southern origin and upbringing. The converts claim to have been attracted to Mormonism, especially by the plan of salvation, linking this life to the next, and by its emphasis on family life and values. In general, however, they seemed more attached to the general Christian teachings in the LDS Church than to the uniquely Mormon teachings. They credited the lay priesthood with keeping them involved in the activities of the organization, especially those members in the South. Yet many who were still active offered accounts of others who had dropped by the wayside because of the insensitivity of white members, lapses in the church's own retention efforts, or simply their own failures to maintain the LDS way of life. Through such reports from those still involved, it is possible to infer some of the reasons for an apparently large dropout rate among black Mormons in the United States. These reasons included, no particular order, discomfort over class and cultural differences with the Mormons in most congregations, feelings of being treated categorically as blacks instead of as individuals, you know, questions like, how do you people feel about these things? Like, you know, they're all the same. Exaggerated attention to black members as novelties of some kind in the way that the whites treated them. Continuing undercurrents of racism in such LDS popular beliefs as the curse of Cain, white resistance to intermarriage or even interracial dating, and in general a level of white acceptance that was considered civil but not warm. At the same time, the black interviewees recognized that these difficulties were the kinds that tended to occur between blacks and whites in America generally, and not just in LDS congregations. In interviews of my own with black LDS members, they acknowledged that they devoted much of their time to counseling black church members. In interviews of my own with black LDS leaders, they acknowledged that they devoted much of their time to counseling black church members who had been offended by the traditional racial teachings in Mormonism. In general, these black leaders were quite restrained and philosophical about their disappointments with racial slights from white Mormons, but they clearly shared the indignation that had so often been unloaded on them by the black members who came in for spiritual counseling, as well as by many others throughout the country who had reached them by mail or telephone for the same kind of help. A recurring source of irritation was the continuing circulation among ill-informed and credulous white Mormons of the old racial myths about Cain and Ham, with other dubious doctrines, especially in Utah. One black convert couple in Riverside, California, reported to me in 1985 that their children had dropped out of church from the teasing by their white peers about their supposed descent from Cain. They called them Cain's kids every time they went to church. Some irritants came out of sheer insensitivity, such as the occasion reported to me by Marva Collins when her Ward Relief Society sisters in Utah decided to raise funds with a good-natured slave auction, totally overlooking the impact of such an idea on their only black member. In short, my own few interviews with black Mormons in Southern California, as well as in Salt Lake City, produced reports very much like those in the Cherry and Embry oral history interviews. While these accounts of life in the church for new black converts contained much that was reassuring and inspirational, the recurring problems with white ignorance and insensitivity were also readily apparent, even among those black members still active in the church. Whatever the number was who had been offended enough to drop out, their departure would be understandable, and presumably a source of great concern to church leaders from the top down. So far, however, this official church concern has focused less on challenging the racist residue among white Mormons than on a public relations focus outside the church. And so then I go into two fairly lengthy sections of the chapter, the first dealing with the church and public relations. And if you live in Utah, as I suspect most of you do, you've probably seen more of this up close than I have. But for the last many years, the church in one way or another has promoted Black History Week, which a month, I guess, Black History Month, which comes February every year, and then the Martin Luther King birthday in January. The Black members in their respective wards, as well as those who come together once a month in the Black Genesis group, have been encouraged and supported by church leaders in their efforts to commemorate Black History Month in a variety of ways. And, of course, the big splash that came in February this year was over the CD-ROMs that the church had produced from the Freedmen's genealogical records after the Civil War for the Freedmen's Bank. I can assume that all of you heard about that. I don't know. It was a big public relations splash. Some of these early commemorations were done quite independently. Marva Collins, who was then living in, she lived both in Oakland and in Salt Lake City. She, I don't know, anybody besides me ever met Marva Collins, a magnificent Black woman? She left to live in the Southeast, and I kind of lost touch with her. But she established a publication called Ebony Rose, and I collected a wonderful file on those. But one of the first things she did when she moved to Utah from California was establish the first annual Ebony Rose Black History Conference in February of 1987. She got Elder Kikuchi from the 70 to come. Now, I don't know what Elder Kikuchi had to do with, who's a Japanese national, what he had to do with Black American tradition, but it turns out from the coverage that I saw of his speech there to be a very sensitive and well-received presentation. In 1988, there was a big 10-year anniversary commemoration that was based at BYU, and Elder Dahlin Oaks was prominent in that, and some of you may remember reading about that. As time has gone on, if you'll go back and look through back issues of the Church News and the Ensign, you'll see many, many articles showing a deliberate effort on the part of the Church Public Affairs Department to convince the world that the LDS Church has changed with regard to race relations, that it welcomes Black members, that it nourishes Black members, and in a kind of incongruity that I think most white Latter-day Saints don't notice, many of the examples used by the church to as evidence of its interest and work with Black people consists of examples from Africa. And the relations between the church in Africa and the church among Black members in North America are two very different things. The history of white and Black relationships on the two continents are very different. You find very little of the sensitivity about discrimination among Blacks in Africa. I mean, South Africa, yes, to be sure. But West Africa, where we recently gotten so many converts, they don't look upon their colonial history in the same way that in the same way that American Blacks look upon their slavery history. It's entirely understandable that you could have a fantastically successful proselyting program among African Blacks and have very slow growth among American Blacks in the U.S. American blacks are still stinging over the residue of slavery and of Jim Crow and all of that, still very recent in their memories, much more than black Africans are stinging over the colonial heritage that they suffered. In fact, Ardeen Watts, who was actually in here a little while until he saw that I was going to talk, he has some wonderful, interesting stories to tell about his sojourn in Kenya, in East Africa, where he said, you know, the Africans think that everything British is just wonderful, and they just don't have this kind of feeling about the British that I think American blacks have about traditional relationships with whites. But anyway, in this text, I go through a variety of examples of public relations efforts and public affairs efforts of the church to cultivate a good image for the church among blacks and a good feeling. And then the next section deals with the question of changing white LDS attitudes and beliefs toward black issues or civil rights issues in the United States. One of the things that I was able to do in early surveys that I did in the 1960s was compare, even this is well before the change in priesthood policy, I tried to, through systematic surveys of white Mormons in California and in Utah, to compare the attitudes that they expressed about civil rights issues of that day with attitudes expressed by non-Mormon whites during the same time. And I found that the Mormon attitudes were kind of in the middle. They were very close to white American averages. Now, but when you compared them by denominations in the 1960s, why, you know, denominations like the Methodists and the Episcopalians and, of course, the Unitarians were much more liberal than the Mormons on race attitudes. But if you compared the Mormons to the Nazarenes and the Southern Baptists and the Pentecostals, why, Mormons were more liberal than those groups. And so they tended to be kind of in the middle. Well, one of the things I wanted to find out with more recent data is what's happened since then. How do Mormons compare with non-Mormon whites now in race attitudes? And there's some good survey data available. Every spring, the federal government, National Science Foundation, sponsors a national spring social survey. It's a sample of 1,600 people like Gallup uses. How you can get generalizations out of a sample that size in an American population is one of the great miracles to me. But they do it, and even with election predictions, they're usually very close. What I've been able to do since those surveys have been going on since 1972, I've been able to go into the general social survey data and aggregate the Mormon subsamples out of that, because if you do a national survey, you're going to get so many Mormons. And after a few years, noticing that because of the population weighting, Mormons tended to get overlooked in those surveys. The researchers deliberately oversampled the Mountain West so they would get large enough Mormon surveys. So now you get about 50 Mormon cases a year in each of those surveys. And so, you know, if I aggregate them, every 2 years I've got 100 cases. And what I have gone back and done has been to aggregate the Mormon cases by decades. I've got Mormons in the 70s, the 80s, and the 90s with, 200 or 300 cases in each of those decades. And I'm able to compare that Mormon subsample with a random subsample of non-Mormons and ask and see how they respond to questions. These are actual face-to-face interviews that are done by researchers. See how the Mormons compare with the non-Mormons in the way they respond to certain questions. Well, you'll be relieved to know that I'm not going to put up tables on the screen and all that, but let me just summarize by saying this. Beginning in the 1970s, but especially and very noticeably in the 80s and 90s, the Mormon responses have moved in a decidedly liberal direction, so that when you look at a spectrum by denomination of race attitudes, Mormons are now on the liberal side of the center. They're, you know, they're over there with the Episcopalians now, and the Jews, who've always been very liberal on social issues. So, and you can see this movement by decade. The gap between the Mormons and the non-Mormons, that is because of the Mormon movement in a liberal direction, the gap between the Mormons and the non-Mormons has widened in the 80s and again in the 90s. So when it comes to questions like affirmative action, fair housing, job discrimination, what else? Intermarriage, who would you vote for president, all these kinds of things. The Mormon responses have moved over on the other side. And another non-Mormon researcher found this information already and published it in a Wade Clark Roof in a book in 1987. And so I compared my own data gathered from the same social surveys as his with what he found. And so that was a way of sort of checking myself to make sure I had it right. So there's been progress. Well, now that leads to an interesting question. If the Mormons were not so different from others on average in the 1960s, but are now on the liberal side of the spectrum, what are the implications of that? Well, in the 1960s, I had two concerns when I wrote about this in Dialogue. One concern was that I was infuriated that my Mormon colleagues were conjuring up all of this, you know, racial folklore and citing scriptural references out of context and all of that. And I just thought it was terribly wrong, and I was trying to convince the Mormons to quit doing this. You know, we don't know why they don't hold the priesthood, but for gosh sake, enough of the explanations. And that's what Mary Sturlaugson used to say when she'd go around giving firesides. She'd say, look, we can live with this for a while, but spare us the explanations. You know, and so that was one concern I had in 1987. But another concern I had in 1987 was I wanted the Gentiles, the non-Mormons, to quit beating us over the head about it. Because I was convinced that as long as the church was getting pressured by the non-Mormon establishment, there would never be any changes. And so my appeal in 1967 in Dialogue was for the non-Mormons to get off our backs, let us deal with this, especially since they couldn't produce any evidence that Mormons were any worse than anybody else, whether they had a priesthood policy or not. And so that was one appeal, and the other appeal, as I said, was to the Mormons to give up all this folklore. Well, some of my best liberal friends, like Gene England, thought it was terrible that the evidence that I would put out there was that Mormons were no worse than anybody else. And I understood that, but my reply was, well, that's a whole lot better than the usual national stereotype about Mormons. So, you know, let's make sure everybody knows that. But it does leave open the question now of whether Gene and the other friends didn't, in fact, have an important point, which was that if there had not been this race policy, would Mormons in the 1960s be where they are now? In the 1980s and 90s on civil rights issues and on race issues generally. And I think, you know, one is entitled to suspect that yes, the answer is yes. Without this heritage of racial teaching and restriction in the church, almost certainly the Mormons would have looked more like Jews and Episcopalians and so on in civil rights, even back in the 60s, because the church has this strong egalitarian ethos and motif we always have had, and the policy toward blacks was always a kind of a glaring contradiction to that. So we can be well rid of it. Well, where things stand now, you know, I've got so much more to say, and time is up, but the thing that remains now for us to deal with is, in an interesting way, parallel to the current polygamy struggle in Utah. What I mean is this. The church abandoned the practice of polygamy more than 100 years ago, never repudiated it, and certainly never repudiated the doctrine. So the doctrine's still out there floating around, even though the church cooperates with the civil authorities in cracking down on the polygamists and trying to get rid of polygamy. But that doctrine keeps coming up, and the fundamentalists keep using it. You know, the early prophets said this, you've never repudiated it. How can you come after us for this? You know, we can understand that you don't want to do it, but don't tell us that we're out of line for doing it. You still teach it. Now, I don't think that LDS Church can reasonably ever expect to repudiate the doctrine of polygamy, because it is it permeates the early history of the church and the early formation of general church doctrine. It's intimately tied in with the plan of salvation. I think all of you know that 100 years ago, celestial marriage didn't mean just marriage for eternity. It meant polygamy. And so it was always an integral part. With the race issue, notice the parallel. We've ended the practice, but we have never repudiated the doctrine that was used to support the practice. So the doctrine keeps floating around. In my experience, whenever I hear or talk to somebody, black or even white, who has learned about this traditional church policy for the first time, and remember now, we're almost a quarter of a century past it, most members of the church living today could not possibly be expected to remember a time when the church had this policy. When many of them don't find it out until they've been members of the church a long time. Even some of the black members don't find it out, and they find it out from some other black member. You joined what church? You know, I've heard about. And so, the interesting question is, when they hear about it, what do? Well, they go running off to their bishop or their home teacher or their missionary, and they ask them, what about this? And, the church representatives affirm that, in fact, that was once the policy. And they say, why? Well, now, fortunately, by 25 years later, what I have found to be the single most frequent response to the question of why is, we don't really know, and it's too bad, but let's get beyond it. And that will satisfy a lot of black converts, but by no means all of them. But the trouble is that the second most frequent response that a new black member is likely to get from a bishop or a home teacher or a missionary about why the church had this policy, second most frequent response is, well, because you folks are descendants of Cain. And the Lord didn't give the priesthood to the descendants of Cain for a while, but now the Lord gives the priesthood to the descendants of Cain. Aren't you happy? And you know, that's where it stands. Now, there's been a campaign that got aborted and snuffed out among the general authorities to get a formal public repudiation of the traditional teaching about Cain and Ham and curses and marks and wars in heaven and all that stuff. And I got involved in it. It's too long a story to tell here, but it is recounted in the Osling book, Mormon America, pages 103 and 4, if you want to look it up, if you know that book. And the upshot of that, I think, or the significance of that is that we do have a growing group of general authorities who recognize the need for a formal public repudiation of these traditional teachings. When it will come, I don't know. I don't think it'll come under President Hinckley, because President Hinckley has publicly said that he doesn't see the problem. And he's benign about it, but he just doesn't see it. And we have in the church this kind of myth of continuity, I like to call it. in which doctrine and practice unfold and develop in a linear, progressive direction. There are never any zigs or zags. There's never any discrepancy between the past and the present. We're always going in the right direction. And so you have this kind of tradition of benign forgetfulness, where you just forget about things in the past. And that makes great sense from the point of view of organizational image and strength and protection. I can understand the presiding brethren looking on it that way. And it'll be fine for most church members, but a lot of black members are going to continue to bridle over the fact that the church has never officially repudiated. They don't even have to apologize, you know, just repudiate the doctrine that keeps floating around. I think I'll leave it there, and I'm sorry that I went over time.
We've got about 5 minutes or so. We'll have a few minutes for questions. Does anybody have any questions? If you want to raise your hand and ask your question, I'll repeat it in the microphone for the recording. Yes, Bob. Go ahead.
I did a little research on my own many years before I was overwhelmed by everybody else's research, because I kept getting told that the reason why the blacks were denied the priesthood because it's because of something they did in the pre-existence. And I kept trying to look and see where I could find any evidence for that. And I think, wasn't it Orson Pratt or someone that made some sort of a statement like that? Was it Orson Pratt or at one time about it was because of something the blacks did in the pre-existence? But I was interested to find...
Was it Orson Hyde?
Okay. Well, I did find something in this little book that came out. Can't remember who wrote it now. I think it was called The Church and the Negro. John Stewart, that's who it was. Okay. Well, he quoted an official statement from the First Presidency in the early 50s. I think it was signed by President McKay and so forth, where they said why the blacks were not allowed to have the priesthood is not known. However, because of our knowledge of the pre-existence, it may have something to do with their failure to achieve other stature in the spirit world. I've never forgotten those words. I've memorized them. Failure to achieve stature in the other, in the previous world. But even that is an opinion. So before all this other research came out, when people asked me whether it had anything to do with the pre-existence, I said the highest level it ever rose to in my research has been an official statement, but it's still an opinion. Anybody have any comment on that? That's what I remember from that statement.
Maybe somebody else wants to handle that. The whole idea of the pre-existence, there's no evidence that Joseph Smith ever broached that issue at all. And, as Orson Hyde, as I recall, it was 1845, a year after Joseph Smith's death. And it was kind of a speculative thing. It wasn't in any kind of official capacity. Armin, you don't care? Go ahead. Yeah.
Actually, Bob, there is a more official basis than that. The Stewart book reprints a letter of the First Presidency that they date 1951. It was actually published in 1949, signed by the entire First Presidency when President McKay was a counselor. 49, it would have been George Albert Smith as president. And this was, in turn, a response to a strident criticism from sociologist Lowry Nelson, whom the brethren had asked to assess the prospects for missionary work in Cuba. And he came back and said, "Don't even think about it until you get rid of your race policy," which is the most ridiculous thing I ever heard, and how can you do such a thing? And the brethren were stung by that. So they eventually produced a letter to him, dated 49, and then later more generally published, And in that letter, there's a much stronger endorsement of the preexistence idea as explanation than the passage that you cite. So it was, you know, at the level of First Presidency letter, it was pretty official for a while. Yeah.
Yes, your question?
I'm visiting Chicago, and the instant reason